Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's the 7th of October 2020. This podcast is another in our series Interesting Times, which is a series dealing with current affairs. In this one, I'm going to talk about Boris Johnson's leadership speech to the Tory Party conference, which took place just a few days ago. The speech is available online, particularly on YouTube. There are several instances of it. I watched it this morning on the ITV News channel. It's about 27 minutes. And it's a pretty typical piece of propaganda, obviously with Johnson's own flavour added to it. Apart from its propaganda nature, the thing about the speech which jumped out at me was that it contained many incoherences, including inconsistencies and contradictions. I've looked at my notes and I've teased out some of those incoherences to form the basis of this podcast. I think what is revealed by the contradictory nature of this primary speech of the 2020 Tory Party conference is that there is no coherent philosophy underpinning Toryism. True to its propaganda purpose, the speech starts off with defining an enemy on which all the ills of the world can be blamed. And if you've listened to our podcasts on the nature of fascism, you'll understand that this is an age-old technique and a fascist technique of maintaining and securing power. So, who are the enemy? Well, the enemy is Jeremy Corbyn, basically, or socialism. Right at the outset of the speech, just a very little way in, Johnson congratulates the foot soldiers of the Tory party who slogged the streets and delivered leaflets, etc. He congratulates them and for helping him and his friends to, quote, save this country from socialism. So there it is, there's the other socialists and there's the evil socialism. And this theme is repeated in slightly different guises throughout the speech. And what actually is being drawn out here is the Tory government's commitment to neoliberal theory and to that part of neoliberal theory which says there should be small government, we shouldn't maximise government, we should lessen government, and we should use the private sector as much as possible for providing the goods and services and public services that society needs and which citizens need. So there's this, you know, classic neoliberal trope: private is better, more efficient, more free, etc., than state action. And socialism here is being used in that slightly American sense of any kind of state action, is socialism in that American sense. Just as an aside here, that if you go back a few podcasts, there is one called What is Socialism, in which we explicate the different uses of the word socialism and the different things which it denotes. But there's a contradiction inherent in this commitment to that neoliberal idea of small government, to seeing government as a problem, as Ronald Reagan did. Ronald Reagan famously said that government can't solve our problems. Government is the problem. And Mrs. Thatcher was of the same ilk. And we've had 40 years of that being a widely accepted dogma on many parts of the political spectrum, to the point that a Tory leader can't deny it. But the truth of the matter is, as I will explicate, that actually there is a huge amount of state work, state intervention, state control, state involvement in the work of those parts of the private sector which deliver public services. Indeed, it became apparent in the speech, as the speech progressed, that actually Johnson had placed his tanks on Corbyn's lawn. Let me explain. He starts the speech with this "save this country from socialism" motif. Identifies socialism as the bête noire, the enemy. Associates state intervention in the market or in the economy, or the state delivery of public services, as somehow a bogey. Yet, a little further on, having taken a little turn to consider how we're all sick of the virus and so forth, in that context of trying to report on and put a nice spin on the global pandemic and a nice spin on the Tories' management or mismanagement of the global pandemic, he goes on to say that we will beat the virus. He liked this metaphor of war. We will beat the virus. We will defeat the virus. And this is the words he uses are these. We will succeed by collective effort. And what jumped out at me there was the irony, because a few sentences prior to that, he's saying we're going to save the country from socialism, but then he's lauding the potentialities of collective effort. In fact, he's saying, and rightly, that collective effort is necessary when dealing with something like a global pandemic, or maybe like an ecological emergency, maybe like an economic emergency or an economic collapse. There's an amazing contradiction there. You know, a repudiation of collective effort, which is emphasised throughout the speech, saying that the private corporations have got to do it, not society as a whole, or government on the behalf of society on the whole, or some kind of organised focus of our collective energy, collective will and collective power to deal with matters that are of concern to the whole of society. Downplays all that, but then says we will succeed by collective effort. So that's the first contradiction, I think, and it's a big one, is that if I can summarise this into something a little bit more abstract, Johnson identifies the Tory party and the Tory government's policies as anti-statist. And he more or less has to say this because of the party's gut allegiance to Thatcherism, which takes that very line, that very neoliberal line. Small government or even no government. But the plans that he outlines and tries to sell to his party for British society over the period of a Tory government, and obviously he hopes to get another one, say a couple of terms, are huge public works, something like the New Deal. He's been advised, obviously, that the economy isn't just simply going to bounce back to a status quo when the time comes that this virus is no longer a prime concern through a vaccine or whatever. And realises that the economy will need rescuing, that there will actually need to be huge state intervention to resurrect the economy. And even that might not work, I would venture to say. So there's a huge programme of public works, improving all the roads and providing wind energy for the entire country, huge wind farming, offshore wind farm programme. And many things of that type, and initiatives around education and training, and money thrown at that, giving young people a better deal. As I say, he put his tanks on Corbyn's lawn, and he even uses the phrase "a green industrial revolution" straight out the Labour Party manifesto. So on the one hand, he's spouting the virtue of private enterprise over and against the supposed inefficiency of government, and over and against the idea that government can do anything. On the one hand, on the other hand, this huge disposal of pretty well a Labour Party agenda, including many items from the 2017 and 2019 Labour Party agendas. And I have seen John McDonnell whinging about the Tories stealing his ideas on Twitter or somewhere like that. And he's right. So there's a huge contradiction. Huge, huge contradiction. So they are pushing this private is best trope in the midst of what they are actually doing. Now, I did go down a kind of a rabbit hole here, a very interesting rabbit hole at this point, because I've maintained for a long time that private isn't necessarily best, and there are a huge number of cock-ups. And we've had loads of cock-ups at the moment. The Track and Trace, which was outsourced to Deloitte and Serco, it's been completely messed up. It's a complete horlicks, complete load of bollocks. Of course, the famous case of Carillion a few years ago going bump, leaving a £1 billion hospital half-built in Liverpool. And I often maintain, well, private isn't necessarily best, and it's certainly not the cheapest. PFI has turned out to be very, very expensive, which was introduced by a blue Labour government under Tony Blair. And I maintain private isn't best. So I thought I would investigate this a little bit further. And I came across a Cabinet Office document called The Outsourcing Playbook, version 2, 2020. She's the 2020 version of all the instructions and protocols for outsourcing government services, public services, to private companies. And it's a pretty detailed document, 60 pages. And I did read it. It's not a lot of fun reading that kind of stuff, but it's absolutely revelatory of the thinking behind this. And it does reveal, in a very stark light, all the difficulties that outsourcing actually encounters and how the government has tried to put these right, or to make good some of the problems that have emerged. Well, okay, fair enough. You know, you learn from your mistakes and you polish. We can't fault them for that. But it's revelatory. And I'm going to use this document, I think, in part 3 of the What is Fascism series to illustrate just how the state and the corporations are entangled in the manner which Mussolini attributed to pure fascism. For Mussolini, fascism was this imbrication of state and corporate power. And here we see it. Here we see it. And you realise on looking through this document that this very entanglement of state and corporate power forms the conceptual underpinning of Johnson's speech and why he has to keep shilling for private enterprise, even though there is huge government involvement. From there, I went on to look at Serco's website. And I didn't know this, but Serco do have a think tank, the Serco think tank, which I think is called something like the Serco Institute. And I looked through some of their documents and papers, and I was particularly interested in a paper on the failure and bankruptcy of Carillion, which was a company undertaking huge government projects and contracts. You know, it was an outsourcing company, particularly concerned with construction and so forth. This paper was entitled, I think, What We Can Learn from the Case of Carillion, something of that order. And I read that. It was written by the CEO of Serco. And again, that was revelatory. And I think it was a paper that was presented to the government as a consultancy paper. And again, you see the imbrication of state and corporations, and particularly, I think, through the think tanks. And again, that was very interesting, and I will turn to it tomorrow or the day after, or in the very near future, as an absolutely wonderful example of this fascism that we have on that level of government and corporation sleeping in the same bed. I'm just going to harp on about this imbrication of state and corporations a little bit more before returning to Johnson's speech and the next delightful contradiction. On the Serco Institute website, there is a write-up about the outsourcing playbook version 2, and the Institute hosted a round table. And I'm going to just read you a little bit of what it says on that section of the Serco Institute website, so you can see where I'm going on about. From the horse's mouth, as it were. Quote, on the 31st of January 2020, the Serco Institute was delighted to co-host a roundtable on the outsourcing playbook with fellow think tank Reform. With significant outsourcing of public services to private and voluntary sector providers, good commissioning is essential not only to government but to taxpayers and society too. The launch of the outsourcing playbook in 2019 was an important step, and the Serco Institute was delighted to work with Reform, bringing together key leaders from public, voluntary and private sectors to discuss how their new iteration can improve matters further. Gareth Rees-Williams, the government's Chief Commercial Officer, and Rupert Soames, OBE, Group Chief Executive of Serco, were keynote speakers. Following their comments, a wide-ranging discussion ensued, held under the Chatham House rule. The event was chaired by Dr. Joss Pritchard, Senior Researcher at Reform. So I think it speaks for itself. These guys are really, really entangled. And I like to see them as basically separate cogs, but in the same machine. The next contradiction, or incoherency, might be a better word, that I've drawn out from Johnson's speech is the ideological notion of freedom. Johnson outlines a programme of house building and some state intervention that is proposed to make mortgages easier to obtain for young people, first-time buyers, and which will only require small deposits and a fixed-term interest rates, so forth, long-terms. So he's promising to do something about the inability of young people to get on the housing ladder, which, of course, was a possibility a few decades ago. Okay, that's going to be popular. And he extols then the pride in having a home and all this kind of stuff. And I'm sure it's very appealing to the electorate, and it's an attempt to sway younger voters who are in general more attracted to Labour, particularly to Corbyn style of Labour politics. But he just come out with this one sentence which, it made me laugh actually, and showed how thin the whole Tory ideology is. And he said, and he made a big thing of this, he talked about the freedom to choose the colour of your own front door. Well, this is the freedom they're promising people, freedom with a big F. And of course, neoliberalism is big on freedom, big F, capital F, and talks about liberty a great deal. And the actual meaning, especially if you read somebody like Buchanan, that freedom has in that context isn't the freedom of individuals to express themselves, to live how they want to live, and all that kind of stuff. It's actually the freedom of corporations to do exactly what they like with their capital, and globally, actually, as well. And of course, this is what happens. You know, you've got global movement of capital, free movement, deregulation, even though that was reversed a little bit after the 2008 crash, and then pushed back again. So there is a fair amount of laissez-faire with what finance capital and corporates or the corporate capitalism does. But it's not a freedom that extends down to your regular citizen, the 99.9% who work for a living. Their freedom is the freedom to choose the colour of their front door whilst they're working in an Amazon sweatshop or working somewhere on a 0 hours contract at a minimum wage with no rights and little trade union representation, given that the power of the unions has been pushed back and pushed back by successive governments over decades. That is what is meant by freedom. But Johnson seems unaware of any kind of irony when he says this, the freedom to paint your front door any colour that you like. And completely preposterously, he describes this as giving power to the people, with a poor attempt at some kind of Churchillian rhetoric and delivery. It's pretty pathetic, really. And whether it's a contradiction exactly, well, I think it is a contradiction. They say freedom and it means something very special. The next incoherency is a big one, and it's a scant regard for the truth. Johnson talks about police numbers, how they've increased the police by so many thousand, and that will increase it by 50,000 over the term of the Parliament, and they've increased the number of nurses, and they're going to increase it to a certain number by the end of the Parliament, and this kind of talk. But failing to mention that the 10 years of austerity, 12 years of austerity, mostly spent under Tory rule, involved pretty draconian cuts in police numbers, pretty draconian cuts in nurse numbers, removal of the nurses' bursary so they could study without getting into a lifetime of debt. And he just omits to mention that fact. And the numbers of police that he's talking about bringing on, and nurses, number of nurses he's talking about bringing back into the system, will only bring it back up more or less to what it was before the cuts. So, I mean, that is just basically dishonest. That is a scant regard for the truth. And I actually believe that many politicians and many journalists have no concept of truth. Now, I know truth is a very difficult topic, philosophically speaking, and I will mention here that I intend to do quite a long series on the matter of the nature of truth itself. But nevertheless, there is the ordinary kind of truth that we use when we make promises, when we make a testament of evidence in a law court, and when we speak amongst ourselves, just in that general kind of way. We have what is called a common sense adequationist notion of truth. And though it can't be philosophically grounded any deeper than the fact that we use it and it works, at least if you can ground it, I haven't figured out how to do it, and I haven't found anybody who has figured out how to do it. But nevertheless, that doesn't undermine its crucial value to civilised human life. It doesn't have to be philosophically grounded to have this immense value, is the point. And the Tories have thrown it out, and Johnson particularly has thrown it out, and of course he's clone the other side of the Atlantic, Donald Trump has also thrown it out. He's somebody with no concept of this adequationist common sense notion of truth and no notion of the absolute crucial value of it. Now, that's the third incoherency. Now, there's a lot of talk, moving on, in the speech about fair and equal treatment in society. Johnson claims that the Tories are committed to equal treatment and opportunities across the board for people, regardless of their ethnicity or gender or sexual orientation or disability and so forth. So he buys all that social justice stuff. Again, I think there's an attempt here to appeal to young people. But there's a contradiction here with this, because further on, or elsewhere in the speech, he's talking about, he's dog whistling the racists with control on borders, scrupulous control of borders, whilst making Britain a very cosmopolitan country by allowing in people with talent and high skills, presumably doctors, nurses, engineers, scientists, academics. They can come, but refugees and people need a bit of a leg up. They won't come. They can't come. And of course, we've had all the filthy rhetoric coming out of the Home Office on this matter. This is a pure dog whistle to the xenophobia that does exist in this country. So he's trying to have it both ways on that, and it is contradictory. And then we've got the derogatory talk echoing the Home Office about lefty human rights lawyers and other do-gooders. This flies in the face of Johnson's claim to champion social justice. The very people who are supposed to ensure that there is equitable treatment in society across various groups are identified by Boris Johnson in this speech as a part of the enemy. They're lefties, they're socialists, therefore they are a danger to civilisation. And I would want to ask anybody tempted by this baloney, which way is it? Because you can't be a racist arsehole and a social justice warrior at the same time. The last incoherency that I want to bring up for now, and I should say that there's a lot more in there. You could mine every sentence almost for some kind of incoherency or some contradiction. And this is the matter of history, and Johnson touches on the issue of statues. I would refer you to a podcast of not that long ago about the statues incident. I think that came under the rubric of interesting times. Have a look back and listen to that one, and you'll see the take we have on that. But Johnson claims that the statue incidents, with statues being pulled down and so forth, was somehow an erasure of our history. Well, this is complete nonsense. It's premised on the presupposition that the Tory version of history is objective and it's the real version, and that any other interpretation of the huge number of facts of British history is somehow that, just that, a narrative, an interpretation, a piece of propaganda. Theirs isn't, but everybody else's is. And this is plain nonsense. As I explained in that previous podcast, history is a matter of interpretation, but it does have to have fealty to the facts, and it should try and have as wide a scope as it can. And of course, the Tories do suppress a lot of the dark history of the British Empire. There's no doubt about it, and the celebratory attitude to it lacks circumspection and is based on a lack of scope. And the statues incidents, in which various slave traders' statues were pulled down by protesters or defaced, and so on. Really performed the task of pointing out of what actually is already raised in by the official history, and which is the dark nature of very large parts of the UK's past, and I would say present. So it's bollocks, again, suppressing the niceties, suppressing what is revealed by a slightly closer look than Johnson seems capable of, and people with the Tory mentality seem capable of. Okay, as I said, we could go deeper, and we could pick out many other flaws with this piece of thin nonsense. And I will just mention that I intend in the next podcast in the fascism series, which will be What is Fascism 3, that I intend to look at the economy and the way in which corporate and state power are tangled up together. And I will use some examples from the US, the military industrial complex and so forth. But I'll also look at the UK, and I think I'm going to be using this material from the Serco Institute and the government's own outsourcing playbook, which enables us to see some of the stark features of this feature of our economy, which, as I mentioned, is one which Benito Mussolini thought was a desirable part of a fascist state. I'll also mention that the history topic is something I'll be returning to, and I do have a series planned. I've got all the notes. I've done quite a lot of research into the philosophy of history, and that could be a two, maybe a three-parter. And I was prompted to look into that by the statues incidents and by the raw thought that I did in the podcast on the matter of statues and monuments, you might say. And that prompted me to wonder if there was anything in the philosophical resources of the huge topic, the philosophy of history, in which we try and take a fundamental look at the practice of historians and the use of the nature of historical truth and the nature of historical narratives and so on. But here it is again, cropping up again, which persuades me even more strongly that this is a very serious matter, and we should, if we can, tease out what's going on when governments and political parties and interests use history polemically. Okay. Thanks for listening. Particular thanks to our patrons, who so very kindly donate us a few quid, which pays for server space. Remember to wash your hands and make knowledge great again. Deabochi, diolch yn fawr.